Okay, something new today. Hi, everybody. Today's pre-accident podcast is brought to you by Underwriters Laboratory, Worker Health and Safety.
So we're excited to be the sponsor, the first sponsor for the pre-accident investigation podcast. Our business unit in Franklin, Tennessee, UL's Workplace Health and Safety, is getting ready to launch new content around the new view. It's e-learning content specific to the conversations that Todd has been sharing with you on a weekly and biweekly basis. We're talking about cultures of learning, cultures of early reporting, the new view, the new way of thinking, metrics, all the things that organizations are interested in implementing in their operations, but may need additional assistance to do that. So these are educational content that will be bundled together and can be shared with organizations.
All this at ulworkplace.com. Now, let's listen to the podcast.
He'll just have to be disappointed.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your beautiful host. That's right, I said it, beautiful. And my name is Todd Conklin, and this is going to be a fun podcast. How is your year going thus far? 2016 seems to be shaping up to a year that is going to be right after 2015 and right before 2017. Good God, could more stuff be going on? Holy guacamole. It is crazy. The world is crazy. The people are crazy. Everything's crazy, crazy, crazy. And it's a little frustrating and scary and wow. And then there's work, and work just keeps plugging along, plugging along, plugging along. And how are you doing? What's your New Year's resolution, and how are you planning on creating systems to support that resolution, says the man who can't seem to keep his resolution over about 15 seconds. That's right. I'm that man. Gosh, what can I say about today's podcast other than I think you're really going to like it? We're going to talk to Charles Major, who is the manager of operational excellence and human performance at Luminant, which is a big old utility in Texas, and he is a really, really interesting guy. He's on the podcast for a couple of reasons. One is Luminant, I think, has done more to codify the new view across their fleet of power plants than probably any other utility, at least that I know of in North America. I certainly, in my experience, and I talk to kind of a lot of utilities, they've really been early adopters, they've been strong adopters, and they've built a really very deep pool that they can pull from of expertise from within their company. And the way they did it is pretty interesting, and Charles is going to talk about that with us. They made a pretty big commitment, both financially, although that's not really the important part of the conversation. They also made a pretty big commitment intellectually and operationally. And what's happened is they have gotten dramatically better in all aspects of the business. And that's the kind of story I think you want to hear. Safety, absolutely. Production, downtime, all the indicators that need to go in the right directions are going in the right directions. And they did it by really focusing very carefully and quite deeply on how humans perform in complex systems. And it's a pretty good lesson for us. There's lots we can learn in this one, that's for sure. Plus the fact that Charles is super smart and super nice, and you'll like him a lot. And if you don't know him, this is a pretty good opportunity to get to meet him. You'll get to talk to him again, or you get to hear from him again. You can talk to him anytime you want to, but you can hear from him again a little bit later as we talk more about another organization that he's a part of, which is HPRCT, and he'll talk about that the next podcast. But this one, I really wanted him to go through sort of his compelling story. Really not his story, but Luminant's story, but he's a good person to tell that story. And so that's what he's going to do. We'll talk on the backside of this. It's a little long, but it's worth it. I think you'll like it a lot. Listen carefully. There are a lot of gems in this podcast.
All right. So,
yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You know, when we get cooking here, you'll get a chance to answer some of my questions for the second time, because
I can answer any question in the world, baby. I might have to make stuff up, but I'll answer it.
I think some of those are valuable for people to hear your input.
How did you get into this?
Me personally?
Yeah.
So my background is, lean and process improvement. And, you know, in that, it's always the part that interests me was not the tools, but what's the culture it takes to sustain it. And it comes down to the fact that you're connecting the people who make and know the product and know the process with the people who create the environment and have the money. And, you know, at the small level, you get those guys together and good things happen. So I was always interested in the cultural side of that.
And did you see a lot of similarities between the human performance stuff and the lean stuff?
Well, yeah, but I think, you know, some of it may be the lens I was coming from. But, you know, I would never go to try to do a lean implementation anywhere without bringing along human performance.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. Why do you think they fit together so well?
I think they go together
in all kinds of weather. That's what you're supposed to say. They go together
in all kinds of weather. But because you're doing the basic thing of it's the power of the people, right? It's not the power of we're so smart sitting in our corporate office that we actually got to figure out, okay, what are we doing that's a barrier to these guys being successful? They both have the concept that everybody comes to work to do a good job. And if we just give them the tools, they'll do the right thing and they'll make us all successful. So those things are similar.
So what moved you then from lean over into human performance?
Well, my master's in organizational dynamics. So, you know, I took on more and more of those type thoughts and processes. And then when one of our CEO came in 2010 and looked at our reliability process, and he was focused on being reliable. Previously, we'd been focused on being lean. So it'd been process improvement. And he came in and said, look, I don't want to be the leanest organization in the world. I want to be the most reliable because, you know, that's where the money is. Now, lean is part of helping us be reliable. I get that. So he looked at everything we were doing and he said, what you're missing is the human piece. You know, we got to have the humans reliable. Everything here is, you know, just around process, machinery, those kind of things. So that's where the group I'm in, organizational excellence, that's when we took on that role of shepherding human performance.
Did the CEO know about human performance, or?
He knew quite a bit. Mike Williams, I don't know if you've ever heard him speak, but, you know, he knows quite a bit and he's definitely a student. So, it's amazing this guy's a CEO, how many times I could go into his office and there would be a human performance book on his desk and open, you know, and, you know, we gave him your book and I see where he marked it up and talks to us about it. So, I mean, this guy at that level, having that level of interest in learning is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. So then tell us about Luminant's journey.
So Luminant, you know, we got into this thing, easing into this thing as a reliability thing. And the more we got into it, the more we saw this isn't just some component to help us become more reliable in that sense. But it's really, you know, a management process. It's really the way we're going to look and think and interact with failure, the way we're going to think and interact about how we actually try to improve performance. So it's not just one thing that we do. It's who we are. You know, Mike Williams, that CEO is talking about, one of the things he would often say is like, look, this will make us better at everything that we do. And, you know, we had great results in safety, but that's a wonderful byproduct of being a better organization, and human performance helps us be that better organization.
How long you guys been on this journey?
Since 2010. So
walk us through that journey. So how did it start, and what'd you do, and where'd you go?
So luckily we had, you know, really great, fantastic top end support. I've never seen support like this, you know, in the community of anybody I know. So we're very lucky and blessed. So we came in with our operational excellence group, which, you know, we have 10 people in that organization, and we became, you know, 80% focused probably on human performance. Now, what we did, because we realized that it takes more than reading a book, is we brought in, you know, people from the outside, but we didn't want to just hear one story.
Right.
So we contacted, we had some people from DOE, some of those who had been, you know, with IMPO, some that came from Nuclear Navy. So at each of our large facilities, we had a person embedded between 6 months and 2 years. So that, you know, we had this outside contractor dude who was embedded with us. And they had, you know, a couple different focus. One of those was to build up our internal practitioners, interface with leadership, but then also walk and know the plant and know the people. So, I mean, they're there every day for an average of a year. It really gave us a head start that was just unbelievable.
That's a huge financial commitment on your guys' part. It's also a huge emotional commitment. I mean, it's a huge commitment any way you cut it. That's amazing. Why do you think they went in with both feet? Like, that's great, though. I mean, how can we get – if people are listening to this, how can other people get their company to start thinking like your company was thinking?
Well, Mike Williams is now – he's now retired, but believe me, you know, we've had a lot of people who come and benchmark us, and our leadership team is willing to, you know, spend whatever time necessary to talk to other leaders, right? So I get it that, you know, your VP or somebody else's VP might say, okay, I see they got great safety results. I see their near miss reporting is up 200%. I see their OSHA recorders were down 78% over the last 5 years. I see that, but, you know, could be just an anomaly. But when the top guys in the organization come and talk to other top guys and say, look, how this happened is we changed the way we view things. And I get it that he spent a lot of money. We did a lot of investment, but what made a bigger difference is every time we had a high level event is the CEO gets on the phone for this report out. And he says, guys, let me tell you what this is about. It's not about telling me who did what wrong. Our whole purpose today is that we don't let this happen again. Now, how's it going to happen? By not blaming anybody, but actually understanding what processes were in place that promoted or allowed it to happen. So when the top guy is not looking for skin, that allows everybody else to do the right thing.
Yeah, it gives you guys some space, right? And there's some space to really go in there and learn and analyze, and people probably speak freely, and that must be great.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, people, the top guys have to do more than write a check, right? Support does not come in the form of just monetary. I get it. We got to have that. The more important thing is that they take the time to understand it, believe it, and then reinforce it.
And that's exactly what you guys did, right?
Yeah. Again, I mean, I get it that we're lucky. You know, a lot of people, you know, same thing happened to me when I was in Lean, is that most of this happens at mid-level management in most cases, right? They're the ones who are just, they're designated to be the champion. So really you're in the middle fighting both sides, and that's a really difficult position to be in.
Yeah. They're kind of trapped in the middle, sort of the frozen middle. And I do think you're right. I think they're the game changers, and they probably have the most production, the most pressures production at all. And also the least amount of resources and time.
Right. And anytime we say, well, it was important to us because we assigned this mid manager to take care of it, you know, that is not going to long term cut it.
Right.
So, you know, what I hope is that they're, you know, in our industry, you know, we're seen as a leader in results. So the easiest result to see from this endeavor is on your safety numbers. But that is not the real payback. Real payback is having people engaged and building trust.
Did you see your production increase?
Yes. I mean, we've reduced, you know, in our business making electricity, so we've reduced the number of trips caused by human error, right? So,
right.
You know, that not only saves us money that we're up, It saves us money that we're not damaging equipment, but then we're also not getting into an upset condition, which can also get people hurt.
Which is super expensive.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah. It goes beyond cost, but
yeah,
it's also super expensive.
Absolutely. So what was your, what was the roadmap you guys created? How'd you do this?
Well,
did you embed the people immediately, or did you start with senior leadership training?
So
I know some of that you did, because I did some of that, right?
Right. I mean, not just the six guys we had embedded, but also, you know, we said, all right, we don't know what we don't know. Every time we ran into somebody who was a leader in this, we said, all right, well, who else does this? Who else is a thought leader? So, you know, we had the opportunity to bring a lot of people in and help us learn and grow, because we were in it for the long run. So yes, we did have that top end support before we did anything else. And I think, you know, if you really want this to work, cascading the concept all the way is really important. So we spent the time, you know, to have our VPs and managers and directors, you know, at least 16 or even, you know, 24 hours of classroom time before we ever talked about this at the sites. And even now, you know, when we do training and, you know, we do 4 to 8 hours every year in human performance, that we start off with the leadership team, and then some of those guys will come with us when we go down to talk to site directors and supervision. And then we grab some of those supervisors to help us co-teach when we go and talk to the craft. And it's just a much better way for it to work.
And do you have your own, I mean, you guys are doing your own instruction. Have you developed your own courses, your own fundamentals course, that kind of stuff?
Yes, we have. So, you know, we do a day for, you know, an introductory. It used to be a 16 hour, but we cut that back because we find it 2 days in a row, it's, you can't put it all in their head and they can't retain it. So we now separate those by a little time in between, because, you know, especially if it's a new employee, there's so many other things that they're trying to learn, right? We want to give them the basics so they can understand some of the nomenclature and the things that are happening and, you know, be safe and productive. But the higher level things, you know, we need to go back and reinforce with them, you know, 6 months after they're on the job.
Did you find some workers became really good at it, kind of experts, and took leadership roles in diffusing these ideas with this new engagement?
So we found that to be true, but then we also, you know, by studying, you know, how might we want to get this really out of our hands, right, into the hands of the people who do it, so it can even spread faster, is that we have what we call HBI champions at all of our sites, and that's one person per crew who volunteers, not voluntold, right, who volunteers
yes.
To want to know more about human performance. And what we do is once a week, we have 4 shifts. It's once a week for an hour. We'll bring those guys in and just delve deeper into the concepts. So when you're first starting off, of course, that's going to be more about tools and tool usage.
Right.
Because, you know, we can't expect that after 4 hours or 8 hours of a class that these guys didn't sign up for. Right? I mean, they signed up to get a paycheck to work at a power plant, not to go to your class. So we can't expect the retention to be super. But when the guy wants to come in there and then he's seen as a coworker, he could take that back and talk about application and answer the question or have a conduit to come to us. That's just really important.
And those deeper dives, you guys taught those internally?
Yes. You know, we've had courses.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, we've had courses on just culture. We teach about a process. You know, we're continually trying to make it more and more transparent about where we're going and why we're going there. And, you know, one of the things that we found, especially with leaders, not that leaders are denser than anybody else, but because of their position, it has often been expected that they have a certain level of reaction to an event. And nature and history would lead them to somehow show they were serious, right?
Right.
And I'm afraid that most of the time that comes out in such a way is that it can only be perceived as a negative and or punishment by the people who are involved.
So what you're saying is they feel like they have to punish because they're expected to do something, and what that something normally is some kind of punishment.
And I think that's nature.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that's human nature, and that's one of the things. So what I'm saying is that we found that we have to almost yearly make a point to have a sit down class where the leaders can discuss this openly amongst themselves. Now, you know, we saw a really quick reduction really in our discipline, and it's continued to diminish as we've made the conscious decision to learn more and to learn deeper. You know, I've seen many situations here where we said, man, we shouldn't even be looking at this. We should take this straight to HR. You know, this is not going to end well. We don't want to be associated with it. But when we dig into it, it becomes the absolutely best story that we can tell, because oftentimes it does look like the guy closest to it is carrying the heavy burden of guilt. But boy, you dig deep enough, and almost always you see that you're the one who created the environment. And that, because it goes against human nature, at least once a year we have a class and then give them the chance to interact around that, because it's difficult.
So creating that space, I saw, you know, I'm a big believer that you can't learn and perform at the same time, right?
Right.
That when you learn, you learn. When you perform, you perform. Got it out. Okay, good. Right? So you're really creating that space. But I like the idea that you're also giving them a safe environment in which to sort of talk about what happened last year, what could potentially happen. It's a smart idea.
And, you know, we encourage as much as possible, like, hey, if you're at one site and this looks like it might go to discipline, reach out to other sites, reach out to other leaders, because you're close to it.
Yeah.
And it hurts you in some way, you know, hurts your numbers, it hurts your reputation. Now, you know, we've had other directors ask really good questions and say, look, would you be taking the same action that you're proposing if it didn't cost you megawatts or it didn't cost you dollars? Are you actually dealing with the behavior here, or are you reacting to the consequence?
Yeah.
And I think that is the most difficult thing that we try to accomplish with human performance is do that, because boy, that's a hard thing to do.
So what's the future look like for you guys in Limited? What's your path forward for the human performance, the reliability program at Limited?
Well, let me go back to the beginning for a second, because I didn't cover that, and the fact that we made plenty of mistakes that we try to help some other people avoid is, one, we didn't cascade the tools. We cascaded the idea, but we printed a tool book and put it in everybody's hand without any concept of how they might use it. And also too many tools, right? I mean, I think that was kind of the thing with a lot of organizations is, oh, if five tools is great, well, 15 would be better. So, you know, we made that mistake.
Well, Charles, we did the same thing. I find that if you don't teach tools without a reason to use them, then teaching tools is a waste.
Right.
Tools only exist in context. Tools only exist to perform a function, to meet a need. But it's really appealing. It's like super sexy to have this toolbox to give out, because it's all these really cool tools and you can get them out there and it feels like you're doing something and this should make a difference. But if they don't know how to apply them, or if they don't have a problem to solve, it's kind of a lot of wasted air.
Yeah. So we you know, the toolbook, we did more damage, confusion with the toolbook, right? Because it had all these tools that we never referred to, never used, all that kind of thing. You know, now we have like six tools. And there are other tools that we're very interested in doing something with, But man, we want to be so cautious about, okay, is it really worth the effort of putting something new on somebody, you know, another acronym, another, you know, because it's not the tools, right? It's the mindset that's more important.
It's the method, really. I mean, I've started thinking of human performance as a method.
Yes.
You know, it's a philosophy, sure, right? It's not a program. Okay, I get that. But what it really is a method.
Yeah, I mean, it's a method that does have tools and techniques in it, but it's the methodology and the way of looking. You know, why does Toyota let Ford or GM or anybody else come into their plant and look around? Because what they're going to take away, they're going to go, oh, man, these lean tools are awesome. We can go do this. Because you can't copy culture. So a tool book, you're not much safer. You're not much more productive. You're not much more reliable with having out these tools and these tool books. But you make tremendous transformation when you do something that affects the actual culture and the way people feel and how much discretion effort they give. That makes a difference.
You know, Todd, as we're talking about the progression, like here at Luminant, and, you know, how we start off and the common pitfalls that people have, and you can kind of see the things that people are going to struggle with, right? And I know thousands of people have asked you these type of questions. You know, when somebody comes up and asks me, hey, do you have a good, you know, kind of predictive or forward-looking metric for human performance? And, you know, I remember when that was really interesting to me, too. What do you see as kind of the steps of maturity around the questions or what people are seeking in the organization?
So I think I would look at a couple things. One is we have to redefine what success is. And so we have to sort of redefine what safety is or redefine reliability. And we have to move it from kind of a negative determination to a more positive determination. So safety success is not the absence of accidents, right? Or the absence of failure or the absence of defects or whatever you want to measure. It's the presence of really the safeguards and defenses, right? It's the capacity for the system to fail safely. That seems to be really an important thing to do early. And that conversation needs to really happen at the senior leadership level and at that middle management level, because we're actually changing the scoreboard. Now, the idea that there are some leading metrics that we can look at in order to understand, that's a pretty, I don't know, this is kind of controversial, but I'm pretty convinced those leading metrics don't exist. You do want to kind of look at a maturity model. And you can look at a Bradley curve. You can look at almost anything. But there's a developmental model that groups will take. And it really starts with this redefinition, and then you have to work through blame. So the reason blame and this notion of justice became so important in the dialogue around the new view of safety is really pretty simple. And it's not because blame is unfair and because blame is mean and it creates a chilling effect. All those things are true. I actually think it's because blame makes mistakes a choice. So if we believe in blame, then what we're really doing is saying everybody who makes a mistake is really making a choice. And the problem with that is that mistakes fundamentally are not choices. And so you have to talk about blame before you can talk about error. We want to sort of start with human error. And I understand that. That's pretty compelling. And it's kind of seductive. The problem is if we don't start with blame, then retrospectively, everything looks like it was a choice. He should not have used the cell phone. He should not have, worked on that without a full lockout. Or, you know, I mean, there's virtually an infinite number of examples we could give right now. That notion that an error is a choice, that's the bias we have to break through really early. And then once you talk about blame,
yes,
then you can talk about error. And once you talk about error, then you can talk about error likely conditions. And when you start talking about error likely conditions, then you've sort of moved the needle, or the maturity model is maturing. And then it becomes really kind of cool because you can go out in your systems and look at all the places where you set this failure up. Because you've removed choice. So now the notion that the worker had and could exercise free will right, which is a retrospective sort of encapsulation of what the worker did, that doesn't become nearly as compelling. And so you sort of move away from that. That's kind of, in a nutshell, what a group has to do in order to move to the next level. And they do it at different times and different rates. And tools become really super attractive, and that often derails the thinking. And also this notion that we can error-proof systems, right, that we can just look for all the places where errors happen and somehow defend against that. That's kind of an elaborate way of saying errors are clearly choices, and we need to give workers less choice or take the choice away from them. So those seem to be the things that are really important. What's funny is that the actual cascading of these things down to the worker level, that only really needs to start happening when you start talking about error likely conditions and learning, because now you're going to start talking about tools, and you're going to start talking about identification of system weaknesses, and you're going to start talking about creating robust recovery programs. Now the workers need that vocabulary. But I actually think you can do a lot of big changes in an organization on the journey to the new view without taking a lot of people off the line or off the floor and sending them through hours and hours of mandatory training. But you do have to send your leadership through a significant amount of training, because it takes a while. And you said this earlier. I actually think what you said was really cool. You said that we don't really give those workers or the managers the opportunity to sort of sit in a room and talk about what they're expected to do. I actually discovered that we often assume they have skill sets that they just don't have. And so we assume they're going to get this stuff pretty easily. So we give them greatly truncated information, like senior leaders get 2 hours or 1 hour or 30-minute overviews. And then we're sort of surprised when they don't make good decisions. Well, crap, we only gave them a 30-minute overview. I mean, how long have you been thinking about this stuff, Charles? I've been thinking about it for like 20 years, and sometimes it's hard for me. So those are the things that I kind of look for. Does that help? Did I answer your question?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm – I think that's what I was looking for.
I heard you writing while I was talking.
It's in my next book.
Good for you.
You know, I think we will continue, like I believe, as an organization and probably as humanity, to continue to struggle with this nature and the biases that blame has around it. You know, one of the things, even if I'm not looking for a scapegoat, it's human nature to not put any more energy into any one thing than is required.
Right. Right.
And when I find out that the worker did something wrong.
Yeah, then you're done.
So that illusion of knowledge stops the learning process.
Right. And you can call that illusion of knowledge a confirmation bias. That's what it is. You go out and look until you find something that confirms what you think. And really, once you find something that confirms what you think, then you don't need to look anymore. Remember, the answer is always the enemy of the question. And it's classic confirmation bias. It's an illusion of knowledge. It's not real knowledge. And we connect things that are really pretty unlikely and probably aren't really very connected. And then we sit back with all the knowledge and wonder how did the worker miss this? Well, everything's really unlikely if you don't think anything's going to happen. And my favorite thing to say to people, and I see this all the time, is it's really hard to notice something that hasn't happened.
Yes.
So anything they failed to do, or the process failed to do, or management failed to do, anything that failed to happen is super hard to notice. I mean, you don't notice something if it didn't happen, because it didn't happen. So that becomes really an interesting challenge. But it's an important challenge. I mean, if you ask me to sum up our biggest problem, it's the belief, at least in North America, and this is kind of a European sort of Eurocentric kind of Western value, but it's the belief that accidents happen because really good workers become momentarily incapacitated for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
So they momentarily made a bad choice, bad decision, a shortcut. A you know, they just for a split second, they sort of lost their mind. And that's when the bad thing happened. Well, that's all about that confirmation bias as well.
So where we are, and one of the, again, why I think this is a continuing struggle, is that, you know, in the beginning, back, you know, years ago, when we approached people and talked about accountability, I said, look, you know, I want accountability too, just like you do. But understand that we built all the systems in which they work. We're the ones who are actually accountable. And so when something would go wrong, you know, we might point out that, hey, you know, what guidance did the guy have? Okay, so they say, all right, Charles, I'll fix the procedure. I say, well, you know, how do you expect him to really remember something that intricate when you only gave him 4 hours of training? Okay, I'll retrain the guy. Well, you know, how much did he retain from the training? And Nook said, okay, I'll give him a test. And at the end of that, you know, once we've had that discussion 5 or 6 times and it's something serious, you know, that everybody has a visceral reaction to about like lotto, you know, we might get somebody killed. What tends to happen is people will react and say, no, wait a minute. You see that I paid the money and ensured they were trained. And I asked them if they understood their role in the process and they understood it. And it happened again. And then after it happened, when you went out and talked to them, they said, yeah, we understood the process. We just didn't do it. Now, come on, Charles. Surely it's their turn, right?
Right.
And, you know, they don't see that as them washing their hands and saying, okay, I've done my part. And that's when you advocate that I've done my part and walk away, you've now stepped away from leadership.
Right. And that's the big challenge there is that what we want. So I have so many stories I could tell now, but we want to believe that the problem is the workers, not that specific worker. And so we see the workers as a problem to be fixed. That's why we give them a better procedure. We're just fixing the worker's problem. Or we give them more training. That's fixing the worker's problem. When in reality, where that discussion went off the rails is that the problem is the way they see the worker as something that needs to be repaired. They really ought to probably think of the worker as a resource that they need to sort of engage and sort of better understand why the answer was, I knew the training, I understand the training, I just didn't do it. The next question should be, how do we get in a position where not doing it was an option? How did that happen? And you're going to dig deeper and find that, you know, there's some compelling reason. I mean, especially if it's a significant thing like isolation, like a lockout tagout, right? Because a lockout tagout has one job. It isolates the energy away from the worker. The entire reason we keep the energy away from the worker is to not kill them. So we kind of understand what isolations are for. The problem is I don't think oftentimes we tend to oversimplify upwards. So managers see isolations as easy and overcomplicate downwards. Workers see isolations as incredibly burdensome and time consuming. And there's an answer somewhere in between there, but the worker's going to have to be engaged in sort of helping us solve that problem. If they're not giving you the answer you want, it's not the worker. It's the question. You're asking the wrong question. If you train them and you write them a new procedure and they still don't do it, then you probably ought to change the question from why aren't you doing it to what's it going to take to get you to do this? What are we doing wrong that we need to fix to make this more doable?
Well, and then, you know, it comes a point where they go, okay, you know, I believed all those principles, Charles, that everybody makes mistakes and comes to work to a good job up to a point. You know, after I've done this stuff, then apparently he doesn't want to come to work to a good job.
Well, they still think error is a choice. If it's an error, right, if he didn't want to kill himself, and he probably didn't, then it's probably a mistake. He probably – there's some reason – I was trying to think of an example. So I was just working with some linemen, and they took all their knives away because they were cutting their hand and gave them all strippers. But then they make them work independently in their own truck. And so knives immediately creep back in because these guys carry knives. They carried knives for years. And this guy cut his hand, and he knew better. He'd been through the training a million times. They bought him the best strippers that money could buy, which actually has a double entendre when you say it out loud, but I didn't think of it that way. Right? Yeah,
well, the whole thing, when they took away their knives and gave them strippers, I thought that's a dangerous situation right there.
Right.
I mean, there's the problem.
That is a problem. But what's interesting is when I talked to the guy, and no one had really talked to the guy. When I talked to the guy, he said, my whole career I've used a knife. He said, by the time I realized I'd cut myself, I also sort of realized that I wasn't using the strippers. I was using a knife. He said, it's such a habit. He said, it's muscle memory to me. Now, that's not an excuse, but it is data. I mean, and it's pretty valuable data. And what it's telling me is that the way these guys for the last, this guy's 30-year guy, right? So the last 27, 28 years for this job, he'd used a knife. And the last 2 years, they'd want to push him away from a knife, but they didn't really reinforce it in a way that clearly caused new learning to happen. So I think the richer question here is, you know, it may not be the knife, it may not be the stripper, but it certainly may be the way we look at creating an environment where the worker can succeed. What's craziest to me, I don't know if it is to you, is how unimportant the accountability discussion becomes after sort of the organization matures.
Well, I mean, once you get it behind you.
Yeah, then it's just gone. It's not terribly interesting.
But when it's there and threatens learning, I mean, we got to continue to have that discussion.
And we'll always probably have to have that discussion, right? Because it never seems to go away. It's always kind of on the back of our minds. What's the future for Luminant? What are you thinking about doing next?
Where we are going is integrating this into a total improvement concept. So, you know, we look at, you know, HRO and integrating it back into the lean things that we were doing in the past, because this is the juice that runs the energy of employee engagement. And, you know, as we face in my industry challenges around, you know, natural gas prices, energy prices, those kind of things, is that we have to find a way to do it better. And going back to the very beginning, the more people think that we actually care and trust them, you know, the more discretionary effort we're going to get, the more we, you know, step out of our offices and instead of trying to fix things with procedures and spreadsheets, you know, ask the people who do the work and know the problems and I have most of the answers, that there's untold improvement there. So, you know, the more we're moving into being more engaging and also a lot more transparent, you know, showing people, here's how you affect our production. Here's how you affect how we make money. You know, it's more of a partnering thing. And that just culture concept is just huge to make any of those things really happen. Otherwise, it's some campaign, something, you know, but boy, this thing puts everybody on the same side of the table. There's very few things I've ever been involved in that, you know, the top people, the mid-manager, and the worker are all on the same side. And this even has the supervisor over there. So it's just, this is the thing that I think makes everything better. Just like Mike Williams said, this makes you better at everything that you do.
So that's the podcast. And the story of New View Safety is quickly becoming the story of performance and not solely of safety. And I'm seeing it happen every place. I bet you're seeing it as well. When we do things well, they are safely done. We are using safety to help understand really that holistic picture that really is our performance. And I think Charles's discussion is as good as any, and it's interesting. The Luminant story is really a good story, and they're very free and available and will spend time with you if you want to talk to them or go and look at some of their processes, procedures, and ideas that they've had. They're all really pretty interesting. I like them a bunch. That's the podcast. I don't know if I even need to say much more because that's pretty much all that needs to be said, at least for today. Until then, my friends, I am so glad you're on board. Tell your friends and subscribe. Give us a high rating, too. That would be nice because hardly any safety people rate anything because that's how we are. But if you get a chance, but do tell your friends, more is merrier, and the more numbers we get, the better off we'll be. So that is a pretty cool deal, and I think that pretty much puts a bow on this podcast. A little long, but lots of content. So as I always say to you, learn something new every single day. Have fun. And for goodness sakes, be safe.
He'll just have to be disappointed.